Hello and welcome to another edition of the In Context podcast. This week, Rachel will be speaking to Miriam McConnell. Miriam is part of Grace Church in Orkney, and she's also part of 20 Schemes.
Okay. I'm Miriam McConnell, and I am currently in Orkney, which is an island off the north coast of Scotland. Been up here for 2 years. My husband, Mez, is a pastor, so we came up here to pastor a church. And I have two grown-up children who are both married and currently living in the States. I've got a three-month-old grandson, and we adopted a little boy who is now six.
Thank you. And you're part of a wider network of 20 Schemes. Do you want to just explain a little bit what 20 Schemes is?
Yeah, so 20 Schemes is a church planting organisation that was started about 14 years ago now. We focus on housing schemes, or in England you'd call them council estates, which are often forgotten communities. Historically, obviously, there would have been a church there, a Church of Scotland or something, but lots of them have closed down and there's no gospel witness in these areas. So 20 Schemes was started to try and either revitalise churches that are in these areas or to plant where needed. So, yeah, that's what we do.
Thanks, great. So you're talking about 20 Schemes started there 14 years ago, and I think that's about the time when we met, wasn't it?
Probably,
you're just launching 20 Schemes, I think. So we've known each other, getting on for 15 years. So prior to kind of us knowing you, and often yourself, you've told me little bits about your life in Brazil. And leading on to Nidri, and then obviously where you're in Orkney. So can you take me back to Brazil, went to Brazil and what you were kind of doing there?
Yeah, sure. So we went to Brazil in 2003, which feels like an age ago. So I guess pedaling back a few years before that, when Mez was at Bible College, every week they would have a different mission agency come in, and you know, they're obviously trying to recruit people and whatever. For 3 weeks in a row, it was people talking about Brazil. And it kind of resonated with him because he'd seen something on the news or a documentary or something like that before he was a Christian about street kids in Brazil and just how they're treated so badly, you know, often shot and just mistreated by the police and by the public. And so it kind of got him thinking after these 3 weeks that, you know, maybe God was leading him in that direction. So on the third week, he thought, right, I'm going to contact this mission agency. And it turned out that they were from Swindon. And now Swindon is where I grew up, is where we met, it's where he got saved. And so again, we were like, oh, maybe, you know, is this a sign from the Lord sort of thing? So we started having some conversations with them. And as part of his third year at Bible College, you did an extended placement somewhere. So it could have been somewhere in the UK, or people went abroad, you know, if they thought that God was leading them overseas. So we were married at this point. And so we both went over to Brazil. I think we probably spent about 2 months there under the umbrella of this mission organization. They had a lady there that was working with street kids, and she had a few kids sort of living in her home. It was a children's home, really, but it was for girls, obviously, with her being a woman. So we went and we spent 2 months there. And to be honest, it was a horrific time. It wasn't good. We felt like half of the time we were just sitting about, not really doing anything. It hadn't been planned or structured very well. And we were thinking, is this, you know, really where God wants us to be? We loved the people, we loved the work, and the country and everything, but it just, I don't know, just something didn't sort of sit right or feel right. But we, you know, we prayed about it. We kept talking to the mission agency about it. And we thought, you know, by the time, I can't remember, it was at the end of our time or once we got back to the UK, we thought, you know what? Yes, it was a horrendous time, but I think this is where God wants us to be. So we pursued that. It took probably about 5 years from that point to actually going out for fundraising, because of Mez's background, sort of with being involved with crime and things like that. The mission agency said, look, put as much distance between you and your crimes as possible, because obviously we'd have to apply for a visa, and you know, you don't quite know how that's going to go down. So he did some further study. He did a master's. We worked at a couple of churches. I finished my Bible college training and we started fundraising, basically. And we had our two daughters in that time as well. So we came to apply for the visa, which was quite a long process. We had to, you know, there was a lot of paperwork and different bits and pieces that you need to get together. But I think up until that point anyway, ours was one of the quickest to come back and say, yes, you've been approved. I can't remember how long it was, but it was like, it was weeks, I think, rather than, you know, some people had waited months and months. So again, we kind of thought, you know, this is confirmation from the Lord that this is where we need to be. So we went, our girls were about 6 months and almost two. When we went to the north of the country, a city called Beleng, which is on the mouth of the Amazon. And we, for the first 9 months, we did just purely language learning. We didn't know any Portuguese when we went. So that was our focus, and our job was to learn Portuguese. And it was hard. We had a teacher who didn't speak any English. You know, there was other missionaries around, so if we got really, really stuck, we could you know, they could call somebody in and they could try and explain it to us in English. But yeah, it was hard. Our house had all stuff all over the walls, you know, like conjugations and verbs and all this stuff that we just had to learn sort of parrot fashion. So it was hard going. We turned up with 10 suitcases and two kids, and we were like, what the heck? You kind of arrive, you think, what are we doing? And there were some battles in there. So I remember we'd not been there very long. So we stayed at this mission house initially, which is where all the missionaries initially went until they found their own place to live. And I think it was within a few hours, this lady, this older missionary came, she knocked on our door. And she gave us this massive folder about, I can't even remember, you know, like rules and how the mission worked and what was expected of us. And I don't know, all this stuff. And I just broke down in tears because I was thinking, what, you know, like we've just had this massive journey, took about 12 hours on a plane. We're jet lagged. We're roast, you know, it's hot, really, really hot. We've got two little kids, suitcases all around us. And it was probably just like the worst thing that this woman could do. I think she was probably trying to be helpful, but it wasn't helpful after, you know, after you'd been there only a few hours and you're suddenly sitting there thinking, what have we done? You know, we've left everything we know and we're in this strange place. So we eventually found somewhere to live, which was just behind the mission compound. And again, we kind of broke the mold because most people would stay on this compound, but we didn't want to. We wanted to be off and we wanted to be, you know, immerse ourselves as much as possible in, you know, living in this foreign country. So yeah, there was loads of times of frustration. You're thinking, have we done the right thing? I'm never going to learn this language. You know, we'd go to church, we wouldn't understand a thing that was being said. We'd take our Bible, but within it we'd have like our, you know, a novel or some book that we were reading, to, you know, because the services are long, like hours and hours long. But, you know, I guess throughout all of it, we, despite the difficulties, we knew that this is where God wanted us to be. And that's what we had to do. We just had to suck it up. Within that first year as well, we all got quite ill with various things. And we ended up coming back to the UK for some tests and for some things for me medically. And again, you know, in all of it, you're thinking, maybe this isn't where we're supposed to be. You know, maybe we've been obedient and, you know, we've done it and we've said we're going to do it. But all these trials and difficulties, we're thinking, well, maybe that's it. You know, it's a sign from the Lord that we're not supposed to stay. But we went back, and after 9 months, we moved to a city, which was an hour plane ride south of where we'd been. And there we'd gone there to work with a church who said that they wanted to do some stuff with street kids. So about probably, I don't know, 300 or 400 yards from their church, there was a big gang of street kids that would live. They, you know, just lived there. They'd kind of taken over a bit of wasteland, and that was their home. And these kids would come and cause bother at the church, you know. And it's from our perspective, you know, when you've not seen them and you don't know, you're like, oh, that's, you know, why wouldn't the church just take them in? And we can be very judging of them. But they're not like sweet little kids, you know. Their faces may look sweet, but they're hardened criminals. They're aggressive. They stink. They're riddled with you know, diseases and scabies and bugs and all kinds of stuff. They come with their little bottles of glue that they're sniffing, which really, really stinks. And, you know, they're unpredictable because they're high a lot of the time. You don't know what they're going to do. They've got weapons and yeah, so it's not as sort of clean cut as you know, well, the church, why didn't they just welcome them in with open arms? Because they're intimidating, you know. If you've got 20 kids like that turning up at your door being aggressive, saying give us water and food and whatever, it's a whole different ball game, really. So anyway, we started a project. They let us use their building twice a week, and we would have a drop-in time. So the kids, they would get searched by somebody before they came in, you know, and all the weapons would be put in a box, and then they would all get them back at the end. But they could come in, we would do basic first aid with them. There would always be some sort of Bible message. They'd play football or volleyball. They could have a shower, they could get something to eat. So we would do that twice a week. And we slowly gathered a team of Brazilians, mostly from that church, which was really, really good. And then I think, if I remember rightly, at least once, if not twice a week, that team would go out and they'd go to different places in the city where they knew that kids were congregating. And again, they'd go with food and drink. They would do a little Bible message and maybe sing some songs and stuff like that, a bit of first aid. So then over... I can't remember the time frame, but after a while of doing that, we found out that a lot of the kids were coming from a particular area in the city, and again, providentially, there was a missionary couple who had bought a piece of land and they wanted to turn it into a children's home. They were working with street kids, you know, and stuff. And they couldn't finish it. They needed to go back home. I can't remember the exact circumstances, but they needed to leave. And so they approached Mayors and said, would you like this land? And he just, no, I don't want it. I'm happy doing what we want to do. We don't want this. But anyway, eventually, I can't remember mm-hmm. how it happened, but we took it on. We took on this piece of land and this sort of half finished building in one of the worst neighborhoods in the city. I mean, like, you're talking, no electricity, no running water. When it's rainy season, there's just big craters in the road, so you have to try and avoid them as best you can, or just drive through them so slowly because it's just all dirt tracks and everything, shacks that people are living in. So we raised money, we did up this building, and then within our project we had two sort of avenues, if you like. So we called it direct action, which was the stuff we did on the streets with the kids, and then we had this other side which we called the prevention, and so we used that building. We started a preschool, just very small, so we would have 10 kids come in every day to school, and the purpose of that was that if you're from a poor neighborhood, you obviously start off going to school and you don't have the basics that kids from wealthier backgrounds have, how to hold a pencil and, all the things that you learn in nursery that they just wouldn't have had access to because you pay for schooling. So we would choose the 10 poorest kids to come along, just to try and give them a bit of a foot up, so when they went to school they were at least starting at the same level. We found a Brazilian teacher who was willing to get, so she worked in another school part-time and she came and she did that with us as well. That school is still going to this day, which is great. We started a football school, obviously Brazil and football sort of go hand in hand, and again it was for kids that were maybe not going to school and were just a bit of tearaways and were heading potentially on the road to crime and being on the streets and stuff. They had to have a certain percentage of attendance at school to come to the football club, again as an incentive. So that was really, really popular. Had loads of kids come to that, and then we started seeing people get saved. So off the back of that, we ended up planting a church there. We didn't set out to do that, but it just kind of naturally happened. So we planted a church, and then we would run a kids club on a Saturday morning. Loads and loads of kids from the community would come. So again, it's like, just your average kids club, games, Bible story, snack, that kind of thing. We started doing some courses for women, just little, like crafty kind of things that they could do so that they could try and generate a bit of income for their families. So we would run things like that. And then every, maybe, I don't know, two or three times a year, we would do like a big sort of open day. And we would go all the time as all this stuff's going on. The team, Mez and some of the guys from the team would go to different churches within the city to try and raise awareness of what we were doing, try and, either for churches to give us money or to give us resources or people. So that's how we found different people in different churches, who said, well, I can volunteer at your kids club, or I can, come and help with the school or whatever. And so we would do these kind of community days, and we would, within the other churches, if there was dentists or doctors or hairdressers or, people like that, they would come and they would volunteer their time, because a lot of them, they didn't want to give money, but they were happy to, I'll come and I'll volunteer and I'll use whatever skill it is. So they would come, and volunteer on these days, and they were always really, really busy. You know, like we'd get hundreds and hundreds of people come in. And again, you know, it was just a sort of way into the community, a way to help the community, but also, you know, gospel chat and all that stuff.
Mm.
So, yeah, all that was going on. And we, I guess after, so with our mission agency, you either stayed on the, wherever you were for 2 years, you came back to the UK, I think it was for 3 months, or you stayed for 4 years and you came back for 6 months. It was something like mm. that. So we were coming to the end of our 4 years. We were, you know, ready to, we needed to come back to tell yeah. people what we'd been doing and raise funds and everything. Mm. And it was hard, again, it was hard to leave. We weren't sure. We packed up everything and, you know, we weren't really sure whether we would go back or not. Mm. I think now looking back that God was kind because, you know, we didn't end up going back, but I didn't know that at the time, you know, and the team that we'd built, they were like our family there because, you know, our families yeah. were miles away.
Yeah, yeah.
We saw them every day. We were, you know, we were in and out of each other's lives. We had yeah. a great relationship with them all. And so had I known when we packed up that we weren't going back, it would have made it like mm-hmm. 100 times harder. They're very emotional people. So it was, you know, it was quite emotional anyway,
yeah.
leaving, but it would have been much worse had I known that we weren't ever going to go back.
And when you obviously you, as you say, you went there, you didn't know anything of the language, that in yeah. itself, even without all of that around you, like the poverty and the mm-hmm. just change of culture and everything, just mm-hmm. being immersed in a country that you've just got to get on with language is mm-hmm. difficult enough, mm-hmm. isn't it?
Yeah.
But having that, how quickly when you're immersed like that, do you kind of pick the language up? It's like you've got to, haven't you? You've got it's you can't
remember. Yeah, you've got yeah, you've got to because you've got no choice. Mm-hmm. So I would think probably after the 9 months of that, like, intense mm. language learning, mm. we weren't fluent, but we were probably, I don't know, 60% or so. So, you know, so we could function, mm. you know, we could understand more or less all of what was going on in church. Mm. You know, we could do everything that we needed to do. Mm. When we moved city, we did continue with our language. So we found somebody that would teach us or just continue to teach us. So I think we did it for a couple of hours a week or something, yeah. you know, just to help us keep going. Because Mez, he was preaching. So he obviously wanted somebody to go over what he'd written and yeah. stuff. But yeah, we would continue with that.
And with the girls, yeah. when you're, mm-hmm. you're setting up the school, you're setting up the football school.
Mm-hmm.
The girls were still little at the time. Did you take them along to things? How did it work with them?
Yeah, so I did. Obviously, as much as possible. When you're dealing with street kids, and you know, you obviously mm-hmm. have to be sensible because you don't want to take them. Yeah. to dangerous situations, but so like the nighttime stuff, they never came. Whenever there was anything going on at the sort of community center thing that we started, they would come along. So they were involved with the kids club. That's where we went to church. And they knew the street kids, you know, like they would talk to them. So you're sort of driving around the city, and if anybody's been to a sort of third world country, you'll know that you get them all hanging out at the traffic lights and stuff, you know, offering to clean your windows and things. Mm. So they knew the kids, and they were funny because they weren't afraid of them. Do you know, they would just say, why aren't you trusting in Jesus or whatever? And, you know, they would talk to them. Their language was much better than ours. Yeah. Because they were obviously just learning two languages at the same time, so they spoke without any accent or anything, and you know, sometimes they'd go, oh, mum, why don't you know what the word for that is? Of course it's blah, blah, you know, whatever. So, yeah, we took them as much as was appropriate, I suppose, for their age. We put them into school. So although they were, well, I guess it was like, so the older one, Kezia, she went to kind of a preschool. And I guess initially Lydia wasn't in school. It was just the one. But not, I mean, she didn't need to go to school, but we thought it would help with her language and culture, you know, because when we were intending to be there forever. Do you know, we didn't think we're only going to be here a short period of time. And then eventually, Lydia went into school. So that was, again, in Brazil, the school system is you either go in the morning or the afternoon. So they don't do full days. So they went to school in the afternoon. So then I would drop them at school and then I'd go to the community centre and help with whatever was going on. And then pick them up and come home. And occasionally we had a couple of street kids that came to live in our house. They didn't ever last very long, but you know, we would take them home, the younger ones, and obviously we would be sensible about which ones we would allow to do that. So as with wisdom and with safety in mind, yes, they were involved with stuff. And I think people thought we were nuts, you know, because even Brazilians, because our car was quite noticeable in Brazil. It was a Berlingo, which you can get here now, but like all those years ago, it wasn't, they weren't very popular cars. And so they would see us come in and, you know, if we were stopped at the traffic lights, often a few of them would like jump in and, you know, can you take us here or there? And you can see all the other people on the road thinking what is going on, or if we'd gone into the city, because again a lot of them sort of look after cars in the city, you know, there's no car parking system in a sense, so they would, you know, make sure that our car didn't get attacked or robbed or anything. So they were like our protectors, really, in a weird way.
And going back to when you initially felt God was calling you to go there with the children being so little, what was there any pushback you got from family or friends?
Yes. people said, well, not my family, to be fair to them. I think they probably thought we were a bit nuts, and they kind of were like, how, you know, we don't want you to take our grandchildren, because they were the only ones at the time, our grandchildren, you know, 6,000 miles away. But then my parents are believers, and so as much as they didn't like it, they kind of understood why we were doing it. But yeah, a lot of people said things, oh, you're crazy, you know, what if something happens to them and you're going to a dangerous place and it's going to be a dangerous ministry, and are you really being wise, you know, taking your young children there? And you know, we would always say, well, you know, if we believe that if God's called us, he's called our children as well. And the reality is that you could easily get something horrendous can happen in the UK as it can anywhere else, you know, a serious illness, or get knocked down by a car, or your house can get robbed, or what, you know, whatever. So actually we saying that we trust God, but are you actually trusting God, you know? So yeah, there was a bit of pushback, but yeah, that's kind of how we dealt with it. And we were just so sure that this is what God wanted us to do. And so, you know, we went for it.
And looking back, like, what was from your time in Brazil, what was your, I guess, what was your biggest struggle and what was your biggest growth for you personally?
Biggest struggle, definitely, I mean, it's just all the obvious stuff of being, you know, a fish out of water, really, so far away from family. So when there was any difficult time or, you know, crisis or whatever, you know, it's not like you can just call your mum and say, can you come over for a cup of tea, do you know, because we were so far away. So I think that probably. Biggest growth, probably, I think just seeing God's provision. Do you know, there were so many times that, we, you know, a big, something would go wrong with the car or whatever, and we're thinking, oh, where's this money going to come in? You know, we don't have the money to pay for it, but the exact amount would come in, you know, whenever we, you know, as an unexpected gift, you know, so somebody would just say, oh, I don't know why, but I just, you know, felt like I needed to give you this money. And it was always, you know, it always covered what we needed. Which was great. So yeah, probably that. And, you know, looking back, kind of when you're in whatever you're doing, whatever ministry, when you look back, you kind of think, wow, that actually, that was a lot that got accomplished in a short space of time. Because, you know, we were really only in that city for about 3 years. And all that stuff happened, you know, and God provided, again, you know, the right people with the right skills at the right time. Just in so many ways he provided, which, yeah, was again, I suppose, on reflection, you see it when you're in the moment, you often forget, don't you? But looking back, you can kind of see, oh, yeah, no, he definitely, you know, had his hand on it. And I suppose that gives you comfort as well, doesn't it, when you're going through hard times, because you can think, oh, hang on a minute, yes, it's hard, but I can see how God has led me up until this point in various ways.
And so you left there, you went back to Swindon, did you, at that point?
Yeah, we just lived, yeah, we found a place to rent just outside Swindon.
And then kind of what happened then?
So then that year, I think we'd said that we'd be back for a year. And it was basically fundraising. So every weekend we were traveling somewhere different, either to drum up new support or to see folk that had supported us. Yeah. So, again, like the girls, they were in school. So it was just weekend stuff that we were doing. So it was, again, it, you know, it was hard because it's not easy every week. I mean, it probably wasn't every weekend, but the majority of the weekends, yeah, we were on the road traveling somewhere, going to a different church, you know, packing them up in the car and all that stuff. So it was during that time we were at a place, actually it was one of Mez's old lecturers from college. He was preaching down there, and we were talking about what we were doing when we were staying at his house. He picked up a copy. It was either Evangelicals Now or Evangelical Times. I don't even know if they're still in print, but they were then. And he noticed an advert for a job in Nidri, which is a housing scheme on the outskirts of Edinburgh. And it pricked his interest because years prior to that, not long after he'd got saved, he'd gone up to Edinburgh City Mission and he'd spent 6 weeks there just helping out and doing, you know, volunteering and stuff. And he'd gone to Nidri. And that was when it was kind of really white, you know, it was a renowned place for crime and drugs and violence and all that stuff, you know, a sort of forgotten place. And so it pricked his interest because, as I said, we had been talking about, you know, should we go back? Or, you know, we had a Brazilian pastor that was leading the church. We had a Brazilian team, and we're thinking, you know, really, they don't need us. You know, obviously it's better for locals to be reaching locals. They don't have any of the barriers, you know, and difficulties that we have. And the mission in all the training, it was always like, you know, that's what you want to do. You want to leave it to Indigenous people. And so we thought, all right, well, you know, we've done that then. We've accomplished that. Interestingly, they gave us pushback about wanting to stay in the UK. But I guess that's a little side note. So anyway, he applied to the job. He got in contact. There was contact details there. He got in contact with them. The closing date had passed, but he got in contact anyway. What I was going to say is when we were talking about coming back to the UK, we knew that if he was to be a pastor somewhere here, it couldn't just be a regular church, you know, preach twice on Sunday, do a midweek meeting and visit old people. Do you know, it needed to be something a bit meatier than that. Not that there's anything wrong with that, and you know, it just, it wouldn't have fit his personality. So he applied, they got back in touch and said, you know, we'd love for you to come up. We've had, you know, we have had a lot of applicants, but we haven't found anybody. So, you know, although the date's passed, that's fine, come up. They said, the only weekend we've got is whatever, I can't remember what the date was. And we looked and we were like, oh, that's the only weekend we've got free too. And so we all went up. And it was an intense weekend. Like every meal we were with a different member of the church. There was meetings in between all of that. All four of us went up. Mez preached twice on, did he preach twice? I think he preached twice on the Sunday. And then on the Sunday afternoon, there was like a members meeting, which was basically a grilling. It was awful. So they all sat round in a circle. And he was in the middle and they were all just like firing questions at him about all kinds of stuff. And again, we left and we were like, no, that's not gone well. They hated us. It, you know, we didn't get a good feeling about it at all. So, you know, we thanked them very, you know, thanks very much. Thinking that, you know, that's it. It's not going to happen. I think a couple of days after we'd left, there was going to be a members meeting and they were going to chat about things. So we got home, just got back on with doing what we were doing. And somebody phoned and said, we really enjoyed your time. You know, we think we want to ask you to be the pastor. And we were a bit like, oh, really? Because we thought it had gone awful. And so, you know, Mez being Mez, he was like, right, he privately said to me, you know, if they want me to go, I'm not going unless it's 100% vote. And if you've been in church any time, you know that very, very rarely happens that you get 100% vote. Yeah. So they had the vote. And of course, what was it? It was 100%. So it was like, right, okay, well, it looks like we're going to Nidri then. So he went up and visited again, and he was looking at, you know, schools and houses and stuff like that. And it was, I think, let's say it was something like the March that we'd been up. We then moved up in August of that same year. So, and then we were there for 18 years, which again is mental because we didn't intend to be there that long. But that's how long we ended up staying.
And obviously out of Mez's time at Nidri, 20 Schemes came about.
He had a
vision for 20 Schemes. What do you think for you personally, what did you learn from Brazil that you brought into Nidri, because obviously you've got completely different cultures, different countries, different languages. Is there anything that you can bring in from one context to another?
I can't think of anything much from Brazil to Nidri, but definitely very, very bizarrely from Brazil to Orkney, like culturally, it's very similar in terms of the, you know, laid back stuff. Yeah, we'll get round to that at some point, you know, which is all very Brazilian. I can't think of anything specifically for Nidri other than, again, people. So the same people who said, what are you doing? You're nuts going to Brazil. They were saying, what are you doing going to Nidri? You're nuts. Do you know, do you not know how dangerous that place is? And we're like, do you not realize where we've just been? Do you know, little kids with machetes, you know, would have no qualms at chopping your arm off, or you know, whatever. I think Nidri's actually going to be okay.
And obviously the social issues at Nidri with high unemployment, poverty, drugs, alcohol, addictions, having come from Brazil, where there's kind of though, like you're saying, glue sniffing from a very young age, living on the streets. How do you, when you've got all the problems that you've got in Nidri, but we're living in a Western world, how do you kind of, when people keep going through cycles of behaviour, is it easy to kind of think, actually, you've got it nothing compared to someone in Brazil? How do you, did you ever think that? Or how's it, how do you
Yeah, no, definitely, you know, because, you know, somebody here that's signing on or getting PIP or whatever it is called these days, you know, we're still in the top, I don't know what it is, but it's a high percentage of the richest people in the world. You know, in a country like Brazil, if you don't work, you don't get anything. There's still that principle of, you know, you work, you get money, you don't work, you don't get anything. And so in that sense, you know, yeah, there, I'm not saying that there's not issues and, you know, people are living in poverty and things like that in the UK, but it's a different level. And it's interesting because we had a couple of Brazilians come visit Nidri and Scotland and stuff, and they're looking around, seeing all these brick houses, running water, electricity, all this stuff, and they're like, these people aren't poor, what's going on? And then you explain the situation and you're like, well, just because they live in a brick house, you know, it doesn't mean that they're not, you know, that their life's sorted. You know, there's still all these issues going on. So yeah, it's just completely different. And I think in like third world countries, again, it's just so stark and obvious, isn't it? The difference, rich and poor, you can just see it. Whereas here, it's maybe not so obvious because outwardly, at least, all the houses look pretty much the same. You know, you can tell if you know, you're like, you know, you're walking around a council estate or a scheme, you know which houses are owned by the council because of what the garden looks like or whatever. But aside from that, you wouldn't, an untrained eye wouldn't know. So that's the difference.
And do you think people are open to the gospel in Brazil? Was that a change more than they were in Nidri, or was the opening in Nidri more?
Equal. I would say it's probably equal. Both very spiritual people. Yeah. So, you know, obviously, like in Brazil, you've got a lot more kind of witchcrafty kind of things going on, but there would be a respect, at least, for God. And you could easily, you know, you can easily talk about the gospel. And we found the same in Nidri, that it was very easy to speak about the gospel. You know, people don't need to you don't need to convince them that life is hard and that there's sin in the world because they can see it. They maybe don't use those terms, but they see that there's something wrong, you know, and there's injustice and stuff like that. So actually, it was quite easy. I think just from our experience, it's easier in that context than in a more middle-class affluent area. You know, very, very hard because people are quite happy with their lot. Do you know, why do they need God? They've got everything they need. Whereas somebody in a scheme is on the other end of the spectrum. So,
and you became a women's worker, and you worked for 20 schemes for several years. So after 18 years, the Lord speaks to you about going to Orkney, which I was speaking to C and Shabba in the latter weeks, and as I said on there, it looks picturesque. We were up with you a few weeks ago. It's beautiful. It's on the surface, it looks like there's nothing sinister going on, but like you say, behind the scenes. How did that transition from Nidri to Orkney? How did you find the transition?
It was strange. It's strange, and it still is a bit strange. You know, sometimes I'm looking out of my window thinking, how have we ended up here? You know, of all places, I would never in a million years have thought that we would be living up here. A lot of ways it's been, it's just strange because the environment is very quiet, you know. So living in a city, you're always used to hearing sirens or traffic or people shouting or, you know, whatever. There's just background noise. Here there isn't. So the background noise is birds or cows or something, you know. So that is, I mean, I like it, and it's weird now going back to the city, but it takes a little bit to get used to. But as you say, you know, the more people that we're meeting here, you're thinking, actually, you know, the levels of, again, poverty, abuse, mental health, unemployment, addiction is high, is really, really high. So it's more hidden and masked. So you're not gonna, you're not likely to see, you know, a homeless person or somebody staggering around or somebody doing a dodgy deal on a corner or anything like that. It's much more sort of behind closed doors. But it's all here.
And on your journey, you've very much, the girls are, as you say, married now, but along your journey, it's always incorporated as a family, hasn't it? Whether whatever you've done, the decisions and you've made, and ministry is included, not the family, not compartmentalize the family. So much so that you've always had people live with you, haven't you? And again, I would have thought that probably to some people would be, whether they say it or not, I think that's crazy. How have you navigated that? And we'll come on to the fact that you've got another household full of men. How have you navigated that? And why do you think that's important? Why has that been important to you as a family?
I think it's probably been important to us as a family because of Mez's story, really. So, you know, when he got out of jail, he had nowhere to go. And so a Christian put him up, a single guy, and then he ended up moving in with an older couple who really took him under their wing. You know, he had no understanding of church or Christian living, you know, any of that stuff. And they really supported him and helped him and were his sort of parents in a sense of, you know, he didn't have a great relationship with his parents, and he's never really known them in that way that you would expect people to know their parents. And so they kind of stepped into the breach. And so I think probably that's where it started. We have always had people, sometimes, you know, male and female, it doesn't matter. I would say it's probably mostly been male, and I don't really know why that is the case, but we would always, I suppose, yes, it's a risk, but it's a calculated risk. So there were certain people who maybe, you know, we would talk about, maybe they could do, you know, they need somewhere to live. And I was like, no, I really don't feel about that, comfortable about that person for these reasons. And so they wouldn't come. There's always clear rules and boundaries. You know, this is what we expect. If you step out of line, that's it, you're gone. You know, and it's not loads of rules, but I think that's important to lay that out at the beginning. You know, as the girls got older, we did practical things like putting a lock on their door, so, you know, they could feel that they were safe inside. And again, as they got older, you know, if there were people that were in the house and they said, actually, you know, they're doing this or this or this, and you know, it's making me feel uncomfortable or I don't feel safe, then that was it. Do you know?
Yeah.
They were told to go. There was no questions about it. And we said to them, don't feel bad about it. Do you know? You know, you're our priority, and you know, this is your home, and we want you to feel safe within it. So yeah, we've always done that. I think, you know, really, it's also, as a side note, we've had great gospel and teaching opportunities with them. Do you know? So when people have been in your home and you've seen them, they've maybe made a profession of faith, you see a bit of growth, then, you know, something happens in their life, and instead of carrying on with the Lord, they decide to go back. So in those situations, do you know, we've had some really good conversations with them about, actually, this is the cost of following Jesus. Do you know, and unfortunately, this individual has chosen to go back to drugs, or, do you know, whatever it was before. They're choosing that over Jesus. And yes, it's sad, and yes, we don't want that to happen, but, you know, this is the cost. And I remember there was probably one of the first guys that was with us, Lydia, so she was maybe about seven or eight, and he'd said, you know, we knew that he was using again, and so it was time for him to go. But we were all sitting down, and she looked at him like straight in the face and said, why are you choosing drugs over Jesus? And like, the guy was floored, you know, he just didn't know what to say. This little kid asking, you know, just innocently, as kids do, you know, just very direct. And it kind of broke, you know, it broke him a bit. It didn't change his decision, but I think, you know, it was a hard thing for him to hear and have to think about. And I think, yeah, that's a side, that, you know, it wasn't our intention that, you know, we'd have people and that would be the outcome, but actually, you know, it was a fruit of having them there. And also, you know, even now, they'll talk to anybody. Do you know, they're not kind of, oh, they look a bit weird, or they're smelly, or they've got tattoos, or, you know, whatever. You know, they'll approach and speak to people no matter what they look like. So again, that's another little byproduct of them having spent time with people that normally, as a parent, you'd probably try and keep your kids away from. But yeah, I think it's helped them be a bit more rounded adults.
And I mean, do you find you come across people that have kind of maybe it's come out of Bible college or conventional sort of seminary, and it kind of, the teaching seems to be everything's compartmentalized, you know, you've got to have this downtime here and this down, not I'm saying downtime's wrong, but, and then there's kind of yourselves who, and I'm not saying everybody has to have people in the home and everything like that. How do you kind of just, because I don't know, I find it strange at times, frustrating at times. Do you know what I mean? What your perception and the way you've done ministry seems really contrary to that.
Well, it's you know, life is ministry and ministry is life, isn't it? I don't think you can separate. And I remember hearing that at Bible college as well. Do you know, like, you'd split, they'd say, you know, you need to split your day into three, and at least one of those three needs to be downtime or you time or what, I forget, whatever they called it. And you're like, just doesn't really work like that. Do you know, what if somebody calls you, or you've got somebody in your home and, you know, they're having a hard time in the evening, but you're like, well, I'm sorry, I've done my stuff morning and afternoon. Do you know, I'll see you in the morning. It just, it just doesn't seem to sit right. And I guess, you know, if you look in the Bible, nobody there gets me time or downtime, or, you know, divides their life into these sections that we seem to want to divide our life into. Yes, obviously, you know, Jesus rested and he went away to the mountains to pray, and, you know, things like that. but it's not, you know, he was with people 24/7. And it wasn't, yeah, he didn't seem to compartmentalize stuff in the way that we do now. And I think it's just, I suppose the root of it really is our own comfort, isn't it? So yes, we say we want to serve the Lord, but we'll do it in our way and in a controlled way rather than in something that's actually, it's going to be hard. It's going to be disruptive. It's going to be annoying. It's going to be frustrating. You know, it's going to be disappointing because people are sinners and they make stupid decisions and, you know, all these things. It's not clean cut and nice and all boxed in, is it? That's just not life.
And so where you are now, you're in Orkney, you've got your house, you've got how many people kind of?
Five. We've got five living with us.
Yeah. So again, you've got your young son.
Yeah.
And then you've got, so what does your day-to-day kind of looking like? So you kind of like a mother figure, do you think, for these guys?
I think so. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, they don't really say, but yeah, I think probably. I mean, we're very clear, like, I'm not their mum. You know, I don't do their washing and clean up after them, all that stuff. You know, they're grown-ups and they do that themselves. But, yeah, I guess probably they maybe look at me in that way. So, you know, they'll chat to me about things, just general life stuff. And you know, equally, Mez as well, if it's any, you know, particularly if it's a guy, if it's anything a bit more in-depth, like, kind of... No, it's not for me. You need to go and speak to somebody else about that. But yeah, I mean, really, they're part of our family, do you know? So while they're here, we do look on them and treat them as if they were, you know, our kids or our nephews or, you know, whatever. Yeah, so we, like, yeah, so tea time is a time that we're sort of all together, really, during the day, everybody's off. So some have got jobs outside church. We've got five at the moment. Two have got secular jobs, two are interns in the church, and one is just here for some sort of respite and time away from his scheme to get some distance between him and his past life, shall we say. So yeah, all different reasons, and all got their own issues and battles and struggles and, you know, things that they're dealing with. All are professing believers. Tea time is the time that we sort of all sit down and we are like this, I don't know, weird family sitting around the table together. But even something simple like that, you know, a lot of them have said, I've never done this before. You know, I've not had to... You know, nobody's ever cooked me a hot, fresh dinner every day, and I've, you know, sat round and had a conversation around a table. And so, yeah, that's when we do our kind of family devotions and, you know, just chat about our day and all that stuff that should happen within a family.
And just finally, it'd be nice to, for those who don't know you, be presented like you've done all these things and life's been plain sailing along the way.
Yeah. But
as I know, Mez has had serious health issues.
Yeah. There's
been situations that you've incurred as family, and also had people live with you who have then gone off, and tragic things have happened. So it's been far from plain sailing. Do you think God's sustaining you in those times? How have you, is there a verse you've held on to, or is there, how have you kept going even in those really, really rough times?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose a couple of verses that I would, or places that I would go back to would be Proverbs 3, you know, trust in the Lord with all your heart, don't lean on your own understanding, in all your ways acknowledge him and he will direct your path. So, you know, trying to hold on to that truth, actually, you know, we honour God and he honours us and he's sovereign in all these things, the good times, the bad times, the unexpected times. And also Psalm 121, do you know, where does my help come from? It comes from the maker of heaven and earth. Those would be my sort of favorites or go-tos, if you like. And it's just remembering that, isn't it? In, as I say, in the good times and the bad, I guess often when things are easier or, you know, don't seem so difficult, it's easy to forget those things. And, you know, we shouldn't just turn to God when things are bad. We should be turning to him all the time, every day. There has been tough times, but I guess all of that has always been external. What I mean by that is, like, between ourselves, it's always been fine. You know, I've never sort of questioned God's goodness in any way, even when things are difficult. It's maybe like, I don't understand why this is happening or why it's happening now, but I've not ever thought God's punishing me or, you know, being unkind because certain trials and things have happened. It's just remembering, isn't it, that ultimately whatever we're doing, whatever our life involves on a day-to-day level, we're doing it to honor the Lord, and he's placed us in that situation for whatever reason, you know, and we may never know what that reason is, or we might know 10 years down the line, but it's just trusting his sovereignty, isn't it, and goodness in all of those different situations.
And so life in Orkney at the moment, that's where you are for the time being. What do you think lies ahead for the next year? What are your plans there?
I'm not really a planner sort of person. I'm just like, right, what have I got to do tomorrow? I think just carrying on, plodding on with what I'm doing. So I'm doing, I disciple most of the women that are in the church. Our church is only very small. I meet with them. I still am involved with 20 schemes. So I look after as best I can, or be a sounding board for the planter's wives. Doing all that and just, I suppose, caring for people that are in the home, you know, the ones that we've got here now. I don't know, they may or may not be here next year. We might have a whole different set, but just trying to look after the ones that we've got for now, and seeking to honor the Lord in all of that.